All right, welcome to another episode of Guru Fantasy World. The days are ticking by and we are getting closer and closer to the NFL draft. We are, what, 3 days away now? It's going to be two tomorrow by the time this is posted. So it's basically here. Christmas Day is right around the corner. And we're going to squeeze in one last episode before the NFL draft with another returning guest, one of my favorite guests to have on. This will be his third year in a row that he's agreed to come on my show, and I appreciate you very much for that, my friend. Welcome to the show. If you guys don't know him already, get to know him. Jacob Sanderson, how are you doing, my friend?
Man, happy to be on. It's the best sports week of the year, man. It's the first week of the basketball playoffs, first week of hockey playoffs, NFL draft. It's probably my three favorite things in sports all happen at once this week. And for the first time in like 8 years, I'm not going through exams during it. So just couldn't be possibly happier to be here with you and experiencing this moment all together here.
Yeah, I love how you say that. My three favorite, it makes me think of that saying, chicken pot pie, my three favorite things. So yeah, we're going to be talking about just one sport this week. We're going to be talking about rookies. We're going to be focused all on the NFL draft. And we're going to talk a little bit about the players themselves, but we're also going to focus on the bigger picture. And we're going to talk about some of these archetypes and some of these philosophical questions and just how we're approaching certain situations in general. So one philosophical question, which a lot of rookie drafters are going to be facing this year, is ranking quarterbacks in super flex leagues. So I want to ask you about how you approach that and specifically how we're going to approach it with this class, because we have what I would call can't miss positional prospects in Brock Bowers and even Rome Odunze, who I've even come around on to call a can't miss prospect. But say what you may about his fourth year declare status, this guy has the production checked off, has the athleticism, low 4.440s, 4.03 shuttle, a good vertical. So he's a great athlete as well. Then we talk about the reception perception profiles drop. This guy's got the first all green chart ever. Everybody's comparing him to Devontae Adams. He's going to be a top 10 NFL draft pick. So Rome Odunze is pretty much can't miss. And Brock Bowers, I mean, anybody who follows me just knows I could gush about him all day. He's going to be, the sixth tight end drafted in the top 12, if he goes top 12, which I would expect him to. But he's going to have the highest collegiate yards per route run of any first-round tight end prospect ever, average over 2.5 yards per route run. This guy is just arguably the greatest tight end prospect of all time. And then we have these two quarterbacks beyond Caleb Williams who have a lot of upside to them. Talk about Jaden Daniels and Drake May, where Jaden Daniels obviously has that rushing upside where he's rushed for over 1,000 yards. People have compared him to Lamar Jackson. He was even further along as a passer than a lot of these scrambling quarterbacks are. He averaged 11.7 yards per attempt in his final season. But then again, he's a fifth-year senior declare. Took a little bit of time to get there. His first 4 years, he didn't top an 80 PFF passing grade. So he's kind of the late breakout, which is not exactly a common trend for highly drafted quarterbacks. And we talk about Drake May, who highly recruited player, had a fantastic sophomore season. But the draft committee is a little bit split on him in terms of, you know, how high they want to draft him, in terms of, you know, if they even like him at all. So I don't know if I could call Jaden Daniels or Drake May a can't-miss prospect. So how do I approach ranking can't-miss guys like Brock Bowers and Rome Odunze versus these quarterbacks who could hypothetically go belly up, in a super flex league where we know if they do hit, they're going to be worth the most. They're going to be valued in the first-round startup range. So talk to me a little bit about how you view those players against each other and how you approach that kind of situation philosophically.
So to me, this is really a two-part question. You know, the first part of it is philosophical, and then the second part of it gets into what we think of these individual players. From a philosophical standpoint, you know, the first thing that I'd want to look at, well, realistically, if I'm coming to this conclusion, the first thing I would do is the players. But for the purpose of answering this question, you know, I think you look at the market and you want to see, okay, you know, you asked on the show sheet, you said, is it a hot take? And so the first way you see that is, in essence, in your league, the way you action that is like, am I losing value by pressing this button? And you are a little bit, but not a lot. You know, they're all within effectively one round of each other. Daniels being the first drafted right now, according to Dynasty Data Lab, followed by May, followed by Bowers and Adunze. But it's not a substantial gap. And then I think you need to look at your league economy, right? You know, when I talk about value in my column, I always try to talk about it in terms of, okay, when we say value, what we really mean is buying power, right? Your value ultimately comes into like the expected value of your team, the money, right? The production on your roster over how many years. What we're talking about when we talk about market value is, what is the attractiveness of your assets, you know, to go and buy stuff with within the context of your league? And how important market value is really comes down to how your team currently stands and the league economy of the league you're in, right? If you're in a super active league in which every player is very liquid, right, you can go and take your Drake May to market and cash him out for his value pretty easily, then to me, you know, unless you have a really, really strong stance on the players, I think you generally want to side with ADP on this and just scoop the values and then try to sort it out later in terms of converting that value into whatever players you want. If you're in a less active league, maybe that's less of an interest to you. I also think with quarterbacks in particular, you know, quarterbacks can be illiquid in both directions. If you don't have a quarterback and you need to get a quarterback, very hard to acquire. But sometimes if you have too many quarterbacks and try to convert one of them into something else, you know, there's only a few teams, most teams in your dynasty league have the exact amount of quarterbacks that they want, right? Especially in the off season when none of them are hurt. So it's very hard to go and do trades involving quarterback for non-quarterback from both ends. So it doesn't always work that way. All that being said, to me then, it comes down to, okay, not a massive amount of market value difference. Obviously, if I need the quarterback, I'm taking May or Daniels. But if I don't, I'm looking at it and saying, okay, now what do I think of these profiles? Because I think it's close enough. For me, Bowers, I would have no problem taking as high as the 104. I even said in my write-up that while I have him ranked right now with the 106, I said I give you complete permission to take him at the 104 if you don't have a need for a quarterback in your league and you don't think it's a super liquid league, or if you just want the tight end positional advantage. You know, I'm sure people that are listening to your show have heard you gush over every possible stat. The most appealing one to me, at least, is at an average ADOT, you know, over eight between three college years, he led the entire FBS in yards after catch total in all three of those individual seasons. So we're talking about a tight end, you know, he's providing a ridiculous amount of after the catch juice, but doing it on quite a normal ADOT for a tight end, as opposed to some of these tight ends that come out of college seams are glorified H-backs who have ADOTs like three or four and are just accumulating a lot of their, you know, scheme touches after the catch. So all in on Bowers in every possible sense. Adunze, I think he's a very good prospect, of course. And, you know, I've ranked pretty highly. I'm ranked like 38 overall in my dynasty rankings. I would push back on can't miss. And I don't think it's just because of the declare status. It's, you know, I sorted every prospect out when I did my write-up on him of the last 10 years that have been drafted in the top 16 that played at least 4 years in college. And it would be one thing to me if Adunze was like far and away the most productive of this group. And we're saying, okay, I'm not going to ding him for having the fourth year. But he's really not. This group includes Devonta Smith, Devonta Parker, Corey Davis, Corey Coleman, Adunze, John Ross, Kevin White, Jahan Dotson, Justin Blackman, Chris Olave, Mike Williams. You know, if that group of players, in which there's some hits and, you know, some kind of mild hits and a lot of misses, the only players who have an inferior peak season yards per team pass attempt, Mike Williams, Kevin White, and John Ross. And it's only White and Ross that have an inferior peak season and yards per team pass attempt when you adjust for age. So I understand, you know, a lot of the rave reviews that he's had on film. I like agree with them and believe them. But, you know, I'd push back that it's not like any of these players who were drafted in the top 16, you know, were putting up horrible film. You know, that's why they were drafted in the top 16. So I think that we've seen recently this profile hit really big with Devonta Smith and Chris Olave. You know, maybe I should not say really big. We've seen it hit, certainly, with those two. But you go back a little bit, and it's not quite as certain. And the other thing I'd say with Odunze, too, is one interesting aspect of Olave's profile is that he didn't really require the senior season to build out his production profile. He was actually not very productive as a senior. It was primarily his second and third years that were driving his production profile. His fourth year was the third best season that he had. With Odunze, he is very much relying on that fourth season. Now, he also was pretty solid in year three, so I'm not going to say he's like a one-year wonder. I also think there's some aspects to his profile that are interesting. You know, you look at the level of teammate competition he had with McMillan and Polk, and you look at how many route combinations he had with three-plus wide receivers and four or five eligibles, and how that can influence some of these per-route target distributions. I think that's really bullish for Odunze's production being slightly underweighted. All that being said, I don't think he's in the same class as, to me, Harrison and Neighbors and Bowers, who have like basically no red flags and no even yellow flags. I wouldn't go so far to say as that Odunze has red flags to his profile. I think it's a strong profile, but I think that there's some nits you can pick, at least in Odunze. And so for me, if I don't think you're like basically perfect, you know, I'm going to be taking these upside quarterbacks ahead of him.
Yeah, I'll start with saying this, that I agree that Rome Odunze is not in that same tier as Marv Neighbors and Bowers to me. I don't think he's that same level of like blue chip prospect, but I'm getting closer and closer labeling can't miss, even though I started, I would say, as low as anybody coming into the process on Rome Odunze. But where I would push back and play devil's advocate with some of the receiving yards per team pass attempts, where it's, all right, Odunze led the NCAA in receiving yards this year. So how much is that really saying that, okay, Washington threw the ball a ton? They had these other, like you said, McMillan, Polk, they had other receiving options to just have really high team passing volume. I mean, how much more efficient do we want him to be when he's leading the NCAA? So that's one pushback I would have. And then I would say top 10 draft capital, I wouldn't be comparing to him to guys like Jahan Dotson, who are going to be late first round picks.
Dotson he went in the top half of the first round. Like this wasn't all first round picks. This was only top 16, like top half of round one.
Okay. All right. I would say top 10 is still,
I mean, Jahan Dotson was a more productive prospect than Rome Odunze in yards per route run and yards per team pass attempt, and was drafted 16th overall. Like, I don't think that they're wildly, wildly different. I like Odunze better, and that's largely based on, like, just me accepting the film community's view of him as being special in a way that some of these other guys haven't. But, like, to me, that's a matter of bridging the gap. Like, I'm looking at, you know, Odunze's production profile, and I'm saying he looks pretty much like Jahan Dotson's production profile. And I look at someone like Neighbors, and I'm like, that looks like AJ Green, Julio Jones, Odell Beckham, you know, all the best receivers of the last 20 years. And I'm saying, okay, I'll split the difference, right? Like, if the NFL is saying Neighbors and Odunze are the same, and I don't think from a production standpoint they're even in the same, like, galaxy, I'll hear what they're saying, and I'll move him like halfway over to the Neighbors world. But, you know, like, I have in my rankings, for instance, like, it's not my rookie tiers, because I have them in my like overall tiers. I have two full tiers of players between Odunze and wide receiver four in this class. So I'm not saying like I'm throwing Odunze into the heap with the Worthies and the Franklins and the McConkeys and the Mitchells and all those guys, right? I don't want to be misunderstood as like I'm hating on him. Again, I'm like 38th overall in my rankings, but I do think that there are levels between where he's at as a prospect, which is, you know, very, very good with some concerns, and where the other guys are at, and, you know, I guess how you fill in the quarterbacks. But that's how I get to a point of having, you know, Neighbors and Harrison clearly ahead of the quarterbacks for me, and then having May and Daniels in between them and Odunze.
Yeah, that's the camp I'm going to be in. For reference, Odunze, four-year player, he's at career 2.5 yard per route run. Malik Neighbors and Marv, both three-year players, at 2.83 and 2.98 career yards per route run. So they are just statistically on a tier above Odunze. So I would agree with that. And then the other thing I wanted to ask about, probably should ask about it to start the show. I'm not that good of a host. I don't know if anybody's noticed this listening to the show yet. I'm much better at just blabbing than actually answering questions and leading my guests into, you know, questions and introducing people. But talk to me a little bit more about your column and what you write about and what kind of your background is coming from your perspective in Dynasty.
Yeah, I mean, so all my Dynasty stuff is up on Thinking About Thinking. You know, I'll be frank, I kind of wish that I had a little bit more up this year. It's been hard doing this stuff part-time with starting out and doing a new job. But I've been getting everything up as much as I can. You can read my thoughts on basically every rookie. I have pretty in-depth on the first 24 and at least blurbs on everybody in my top 48 right now. But what I really try to do in the column is, like, I mean, I'll just be honest. Like, there's people who have put in the time of designing models that are going to be, you know, more predictive analytically than what I'm going to provide. And there's people that are going to be able to put in, you know, a lot of film work. I do a good amount of film work on the running backs, less so on the receivers, but who, you know, I think are more experienced and going to be better at it. I think that what I try to do in my column in particular is try to put together, you know, a general understanding of these prospects from both of those angles. And I certainly give my evaluation and my take on them. And then also try to put it in that strategic lens of how, you know, how am I actually game planning my way through these rookie drafts? What do I see as the tiers? What do I see as, you know, the players who I think are really undervalued, and then specifically kind of how am I going to position myself in to go and get them? You know, that's probably the common thread to a lot of what I try to do in the column, is try to put in that sort of game theory perspective. You know, I really love your last question on the show sheet that we'll get to kind of talk through that. But blending that, you know, with the film, with the data profiles, but certainly you can read my thoughts on every rookie in this class. Where I'm thinking about thinking. I released my last column in that series just this morning. So.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend to anybody to check that out. And that's what I kind of try to focus on most of this show sheet, because I would say you're one of the best, if not the best, at diving into that, like you said, that game theory and the strategy behind the process and about the why, you know, but why are we doing this? What is the logic behind a certain decision in Dynasty, which is huge. And especially because, talk about how popular Dynasty is becoming, the player takes are getting... You could get player take left and right. I mean, everybody knows everything about every player at this point.
Oh, like, that's for sure. There's
not a data nugget uncovered. So the really helpful information is going to be that next level stuff, you know, below the surface, where we're talking about digging deeper into the process. And that's a good lead into the next question. And we want to talk about this rookie wide receiver class, because first I talked about the first dilemma facing rookie drafter this year is kind of where to slot in these quarterbacks versus the positional players. And I would say the second dilemma, at least for me, is kind of when I get down into that late first range, and it becomes putting certain wide receiver archetypes up against each other. And one of them that's just a tough decision this year is, do we draft an undersized rookie wide receiver who had solid yard per route run numbers, or an alpha-sized wide receiver who had poor yard per route numbers? Talking about both of these guys didn't have great team market shares, but both of these guys have good reception perception profiles. Both are projected first or second round picks. Both are good athletes. And that would be Ladd McConkey and Adonai Mitchell, where McConkey has good yard per route run numbers. When we look at his team shares, they weren't as good. He was not a full-time player. He dealt with some injuries, but yards per run, 2.71, 2.16, 3.26 in three seasons. But he's obviously a little bit undersized. We look at his reception-perception profile, above 80% in man versus zone, but he was below 10th percentile versus press. So kind of like a Tyler Lockett comp. Then on the flip side, we have Adonai Mitchell, where he was at 1.66, 1.56, 1.72 yards per run. He didn't clear 2 yards per run in any of his three seasons. McConkey was above doing all three. But Adonai Mitchell is a fantastic athlete, 4'3", 40, 39.5-inch vertical. He had a great reception perception profile. He's above 80th percentile versus man, above 80th percentile versus press. I think he was in the mid-30s versus zone, which is not great. But he had a very good film grade. He could be drafted ahead of Ladd McConkey in the NFL draft. So it's like, well, which guy do I go with? Do I go with the guy who's kind of safer, but he has more of that wide receiver two profile, or do I go with the boom bust wide receiver who could be gold or he could be shit, you know? So how do you approach a situation like that?
Well, you know, the short answer is it's really hard. I don't even know exactly how I'm going to have these two ranked today. You know, I know I have them ranked today, but I don't know if that will be the same way that I have them ranked after the NFL draft. You know, you mentioned how flat it gets. I mean, just in this class, like I do my overall rankings with the tiers that have the base pick value of each tier. And so the way it just kind of ends up, you know, as I'm slotting these rookies in, I'm not really trying to necessarily tier the rookies as much as I'm just slotting them into my overall rankings. And the end result is that I don't actually have a single player in this class ranked right now in my late first value tier. When one of them might jump into there after a draft day. But the way it goes right now, I have, you know, the top seven in this class, I have all ranked above a base first, including Odunze. I have McCarthy ranked as exactly a base first. And then I have nobody in the late one ranked. And I have like seven guys in the early two and another half dozen in the base two range. And it really flattens out from there. So the guy I have ranked higher right now is Ladd McConkey between the two of them. But I do have them both in the same tier. And I'm interested that you said that Adonai Mitchell was boom bust. I'm glad you said that because that's what a lot of people have said about him. And I wrote about this quite specifically in the column that I posted today. And this actually goes back to one of my first ever Thinking About Thinking columns, which was sort of the fantasy perception of ceiling versus floor and how, you know, certain types of guys, when you know, they do really well, we say, oh, well, their floor is higher. I just still worry about their ceiling. Or certain guys, you know, they do really poorly, and we say, oh, their floor just got a lot lower, but their ceiling's really high. Like, and I wonder, like, is there a method to all of this, or is it somewhat arbitrary, or is it just sort of intuitive? And are we actually very good at separating medians from ceilings, or are we just kind of going off of vibes? And with Mitchell, I've been playing this through a lot in my head because, I mean, it's not a profile that I gravitate towards, right? We're talking about of all the rookie wide receivers in this tier, frankly, even in two tiers, almost all of them have at least at some point earned volume in some way. Maybe that volume has not been as on as many routes as we want, like a Ladd McConkey. Maybe that volume has been earned, you know, in the fifth year of your college career for the first time, like a Xavier Legette. You know, maybe it's earned in somewhat of a Mickey Mouse type of role that we're not really sure how it's going to translate, you know, maybe like an Xavier Worthy. But in some way or somehow, almost everybody else in this tier has actually earned it and has been, to some extent, efficient on it. And Adonai Mitchell has never really earned volume, and he's never been particularly efficient on his volume. You know, 0.175 targets per route run in this third year comes in, as you mentioned, a 1.72 yards per route run. And so, however, I keep thinking, oh my God, you know, here's this guy who a lot of film people think can play X wide receiver in the NFL. You look at his reception perception chart, you think about his draft capital, and it's like, what if this guy goes to the Bills and he's the 1-9? Like, it's frightening to fade this big athletic guy who some people really believe in as a route runner. And you're thinking, man, like, you know, how can I stomach this? The ceiling's off the charts. And I don't know if this is right, but what I've ultimately settled on is I don't think that his inability to earn volume is like only detrimental to his floor. Like, I think generally speaking, I believe to some extent that whether it be the offense or the quarterback or the role or whatever it is, that maybe he's better than his production indicates. He's almost certainly better than his production indicates because his production indicates he should be a day three pick. But if he was actually such a high ceiling player, right? If he was like this truly elite player, why do we need all of these litany of excuses to try and ease our way back up to acceptable production, right? I mean, I think more often than not, some of these profiles, and especially this like big alpha wide receiver profile, a lot of times when they do hit, it's not necessarily this like, oh my God, the ceiling is upon us. It's like, right? Like, I think George Pickens lives in this world and like, he's a hit, but like the ceiling on him, maybe it will be at some point, but like to this point, it looks like it's a mild hit. Like it doesn't look like it's like a, he's a top five wide receiver in the NFL hit. You know, DK Metcalf, I would argue, has not actually been that high of a ceiling. Like it's, if you drafted DK Metcalf in rookie drafts, you're very happy that you did. There were several worse picks. He's not a league winning, league dominating player. So I just think that just because he's big and fast and plays X wide receiver, like I'm not sure that that means necessarily that his ceiling and his hit is necessarily going to be that much more impactful than the hit of some of these other guys. And so I'm trying to dispel some of the FOMO. He comes into my wide receiver seven. I like McConkey more. He is the archetype of wide receiver I want to be targeting. He profiles as a slot flanker, which is really encouraging to me because he makes him a little bit less reliant on a quarterback or on pass volume of the offense, because he's going to be running that steady diet of routes over the middle. I think he can do enough on the outside to be able to stay on the field in two wide receiver sets as a flanker, certainly not as an X wide receiver. I think he's a safer pick, but I also think ultimately wide receiver ceiling comes down to volume, and McConkey has been able to earn that more consistently on a per route basis, at least. So that's the guy I go with.
Yeah, I'm glad you came around to George Pickens, because I was about to go there if you weren't. And I've been, I would say, higher on George Pickens than consensus throughout Pickens' career, where I would say you might have been a little bit lower. I know we debated Pickens versus Deontay before.
Yeah.
But even most Adonai Mitchell believers would say and agree and point to George Pickens as an optimal outcome for Adonai Mitchell. And to your point, George Pickens right now, the number one wide receiver on his team, coming off an 1,100 yard year two. And he's valued as, what, a sixth-round startup pick? So it's not like the boom went the dynamite. I mean, he still has room to go up. You could still argue Pickens is undervalued. But again, that's more of the optimal outcome for Adonai Mitchell, where we have, less optimal outcomes, available as well. So that's a good point you bring up about ceiling versus floor. I'm glad you went into that a little bit. Let's talk about situation, because we were talking about, what if, Adonai Mitchell goes to Buffalo. How do we juggle productive wide receivers, say in Xavier Worthy in a Philadelphia versus an unproductive wide receiver, say not even Mitchell, say someone like Keon Coleman in Buffalo? How do we rank that, and how high do we push up whichever shitty wide receiver goes to Buffalo?
Yeah, I mean, high, right? Like I think this tier is flat enough at wide receiver that I don't think that it's crazy to just say like, yeah, I like the ones with the good landing spots and good draft capital the most. I think the sketchier question is, what happens if Buffalo doesn't take a wide receiver in the first round? They take a wide receiver at the end of the second round. What happens if the Cowboys don't take a running back at the end of the second round? They take a running back at the end of the third round. That's where it gets more interesting, is like, and this gets back into like the Sky Moore conundrum from a while ago. It's like, what happens if we get the dream landing spot, but not the dream draft capital? That's where it's a little bit scarier. If we get, late round two, Benson or Brooks to the Cowboys, if we get late round one, any of these wide receivers to the Bills, like I'm going to be pretty wheels up with that in terms of, maybe the gap between that player and the rest of this tier is too wide for me and I end up trading out of it. But at the very least, would I just say like, yeah, my wide receiver four is the first round wide receiver on the Bills. That's where I'm at, because I think it's tight enough in this class. You brought up
a little far down for me. I have Keon Coleman ranked right now at wide receiver 10. It's a long way up to four from there. My rule of thumb is that a landing spot should be worth one tier at most. I have him in a tier below the top four of this tier. So I have 4 through 7 in a tier. I have 8 through 11, I believe, in a tier, maybe 8 through 12. And Coleman would certainly get into that next group for me with this Bills landing spot. Probably still ends up behind one of these other four, whoever one of them gets a good landing spot themselves. If it's like Brian Thomas goes to the Jaguars and Coleman goes to the Bills, I'll take Thomas and the Jaguars. But I could see a scenario where he still jumps a couple people in the tier ahead. Like if we get Coleman on the Bills and we get, McConkey on the 49ers, right? Like what are we going to do with that? He's not scoring any points this year. And they don't trade IU. Like that's not ideal, right? So would I prefer Coleman there? I could see the argument, you know, at the very least, if the market did it that way, probably I'd probably swap that way too. So something like that is kind of where I would end up leaning with it. Yeah, as for Coleman himself, I mean, it's not a profile I like at all. Doesn't win consistently on the outside, not productive. You know, normally it's the super productive players in this value tier are the ones that the film community is talking about. Oh, they might not be able to play this role they played in college. We have to get moved to the inside. And we're debating how seriously to take that. You know, we're hearing stuff like that about Coleman, and he doesn't actually produce at all in college either. So that makes me sketched out. But it seems like he's the one, you know, of this kind of trio of wide receivers who haven't earned volume at a particularly impressive rate in this class that are might go first round anyways. He seems like the one that's most universally hated by the analytics community. So as much as I don't really like him, I wouldn't be surprised if I ended up even overweight on him. Because I might dislike him as much as everyone else, but I might be less attached to my dislike of Coleman compared to other people. So I could see myself drafting him, you know, in the late second, even in some drafts with more data inclined folks.
Yeah, just one thing to note, it looked like your screen flashed and you sound a little different. I'm not sure if your mic was unplugged and you want to replug that, and I can't edit it. But that's just one thing of note.
Yeah, I must have just hit my mic and disengaged it for a second there. But anyway, we're good.
Yeah, so you talk about if it's not a round one wide receiver, I think I'm preparing myself. Everybody wants a good wide receiver to Buffalo. It's going to be like Roman Wilson or Jalen Polk in like the late second round. That's what I'm rooting for, is I want chaos. I want bad profiles getting pushed up so I can draft the good players, you know? So I would much rather that than have, you know, a wide receiver I like Xavier Worthy go to Buffalo. And then it's like, all right, now I can't draft any more Xavier Worthy because everybody wants to draft him now.
Yeah. That's the thing for sure. I mean, that would be the most interesting turn of events. I agree. Is if we do get like late two, and it's, you know, insert random unsexy wide receiver. Where does that player get drafted? I don't know. I have no idea. And I'm not going to say whether I'd be into them or fade them because I don't know how the market's going to react to that. Right? Like, I don't think the market reacts in a very predictable or consistent fashion to that. You know, we've seen now three second round Chiefs wide receivers. We've seen them push up one with a really, really questionable profile, Mecole Hardman. We've seen the market push up one with a, you know, we were wrong, but what we thought was a good profile in Sky Moore. And then we saw them draft, you know, Rashee Rice, who had a bad profile, and nobody cared that he was on the Chiefs, right? Like if he, you know, at all. So, you know, I didn't like Rashee Rice remotely as a prospect until he went to the Chiefs, but I remember even in my column last year being like, I'm not really sure why he's going behind like Jonathan Mingo. Like there's all these bad prospects that got drafted, but like, why don't we just take the one on the Chiefs if we have to break the tie, you know, like, so, you know, I'm not like giving myself clairvoyance on Rice because he's infinitely better than I thought he was. But yeah, so I don't know. I think if the Bills, maybe we all learned our lesson now from Rice, maybe we didn't. I have no idea. I know if the Bills draft someone that the community likes, that they'll go very highly. If the Bills draft Keon Coleman, I couldn't tell you how the community is going to act. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point you bring up about how the last time we tried a process really affects whether we want to continue the process in the future again. Like how much of us fading Rashee Rice in the second round of the Chiefs had to do with Sky Moore blowing up in all of our faces the year before. If Sky Moore was never drafted, how much higher would we all have been on Rashee Rice, you know, if we didn't have that sour taste in our tongue, you know? And I think some of it's kind of with Jane Daniels, like, all right, we're all pointing to Trey Lance and Justin Fields, you know, those are the bad outcomes, but what if one of those guys hits? We would have been pointing to them as the right outcome for Jane Daniels. So
of course
it's hard to use one or two examples to define a process. So I think it's a good point to look back further and to make sure, you know, you want to use something as a process that's held up over time and not just maybe one or two seasons. So let's talk a little bit more about process. We're going to transition to the quarterbacks a little bit, because we talk about not just landing spot, but draft capital. Even if these guys get a good landing spot, if they're round two NFL draft picks, how high can they go in a good landing spot, and how low would we drop them if it's, you know, maybe a little bit less of a clear landing spot?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I'm out on this Michael Penix is going in round one thing. You know, the draft is like in 3 days, so this could be a cold take within 72 hours. But I don't understand this, man. I don't understand this. He has one career season above 9 adjusted yards per attempt. He barely cleared it. That was in his sixth season. You know, most college players get 4. We really love when they declare after 3. COVID gave everybody a 5th. He got a 6th because of an injury redshirt. It took him until his 6th season to actually have interesting level production. In that season, of course, he has, like, I think, pretty clearly, in my opinion, the best wide receiver group in the nation, with one likely top 10 pick, 2 more likely day 2 picks on his team in Dunze, McMillan, and Polk. You know, he's playing with an offensive line that, I don't study offensive lines, but one of them's going in the first round, and they were good enough to get him to the national championship game, so they're probably pretty reasonable. And still not all that efficient. Just watching him, I think his accuracy is quite inconsistent. You know, his deep, people bring up his deep ball, his deep passing. Arm strength, 100%. Got great arm strength. I don't think he's actually a very accurate deep ball passer. I think they just throw deep a lot, and he happens to hit them at a kind of an average rate, and so the overall rate of deep completions is high. And then the thing that people always bring up about him that's positive, oh, he never takes sacks. And that's true. He never takes sacks. But you look at his EPA, his QBR, and his adjusted completion percentage, and his rate of converting first downs when pressured, and it's the worst of any of the top guys in this class, because he doesn't take sacks. He doesn't do anything either. He doesn't run away from them. He doesn't playmake. He just throws the ball away, and that's better than taking a sack. But, you know, sometimes I think we get really into these statistics, and we forget what we're actually trying to capture, which is, you know, the reason why we hate sacks is because it's a really negative impact on your ability to sustain drives. But if you're so averse to playmaking or just unable to do it after the injuries that every time you're pressured, you're just immediately throwing the ball away, and this like never-ending run of paper cuts is actually a larger net negative than a quarterback who does take some sacks but actually tries to playmake, like, I'd rather have that guy, right? I'd rather have the higher sack rate who is still producing better offense under pressure. And then from a fantasy perspective, he doesn't even run. You know, people bring up his 40-yard dash. Okay, he had 8 rushing yards last year. 8. So this isn't a matter of, like, Justin Fields, you know, oh, his rushing market share wasn't that high, but look at how athletic he is. He's going to run more in the NFL. Justin Fields ran way more in the NFL than college. He did run in college. Penix was a statue in college. There's nothing about his game that suggests he's even mobile as, like, a pocket manager. I don't think that he's going to be running in the NFL. And I'm not saying his 40 time is wrong. I'm just saying, okay, we know we can run in a fast, straight line. That is not translated to rushing, either because he's unwilling to rush or he doesn't have the lateral mobility or whatever it is, but he doesn't do it. So I don't understand why he's going to go in the first round. I am ranked further behind ADP than any other player in the top 24 in my rankings. I don't think he's a good prospect. If he does go in round one, the only guys I think would be remotely comparable in recent history are like Kenny Pickett and Brandon Weeden. Obviously, I'll move him up from where I have him if he goes in round one, just out of deference for the fact that that means he probably gets 2 years as a starting quarterback, but I'm still not going to be excited to take him. I'll still let the market price me out. I'm probably not ranking him higher than the early second round of rookie drafts. Knicks, I like more. I also think it would be weird if he went in round one, just because I don't think he has that much upside. I said he's like J.J. McCarthy without the benefit of the unknown, is kind of how I feel about Bo Nix, where, like, with McCarthy, I look at him and I say, okay, that's a guy who has sufficient athleticism. He's accurate in the short and intermediate areas of the field. You know, he avoids mistakes at a really high rate. And that's a guy who can run an NFL offense. And he's 21. He was in this weird Harbaugh offense. Maybe he can do that and do a lot more that he just hasn't gotten the chance to show yet. With Knicks, we saw him kind of have to play backyard football at Auburn. It didn't go well. He was really inefficient. He led a lot of bad offenses. He gets put into the system in Oregon where he's throwing, you know, short of the sticks pretty frequently and operating at a much higher pace. And he's able to do that really effectively. So to me, if he goes to Denver and Sean Payton just makes him his quarterback and it's like, all right, all you got to do is you got to play with pace. You got to do one read, look the middle of the field. Is it open? Throw a slant. If it's not open, throw to the back. Like Nix can do that. He doesn't make a lot of mistakes. He doesn't take sacks. He's accurate. I think he'll start for a while in the NFL if he's given a chance to. I think he can be like an Andy Dalton, Derek Carr, Teddy Bridgewater type of quarterback. You know, these are all guys who went at the very end of the first or very early in the second. I think that makes sense for Nix. And I think, you know, if you can get him around the 1-2 turn where you don't really need that much fantasy upside out of him, that's, I think, probably a reasonable play in Superflex, where if you just need a guy to start at QB2 for you for 3-4 years, you know, if you drafted Derek Carr early second in your rookie drafts and you've just had a QB2 or a QB3 for life, that's a great use of a pick in Superflex. So I'm more into Nix than Penix, but not super excited about his upside. What do you think on those guys?
Yeah, I don't really have a strong take on their NFL ability. I'm certainly more interested in Nix for fantasy just based on his rushing ability. And you already mentioned the 8 rushing yards for Michael Penix. Nix was at 97 attempts, 313 yards, and 7 touchdowns as a freshman. 108 attempts for 388 yards, 7 rushing touchdowns as a sophomore. As a senior, he had 510 rushing yards and 14 rushing touchdowns. So we just saw him a lot more involved as a rusher, which, you know, is obviously going to make a big difference in fantasy. Whereas, as you said, statue for Michael Penix, even though he has that athleticism. And to your point, I think those would be bad reasons to push up Michael Penix would be, you know, the athleticism when you don't see it, him utilize that ability as a scrambler in game and the ability to avoid sacks when he's not necessarily making plays out of them. But I do think that could be a reason that NFL general managers used to draft him in the first round. So I wouldn't be totally shocked if somebody makes the wrong decision based off of that reasoning and takes him, because I do think there are still quarterback needing teams out there. And I would say the one thing where I would escape saying, all right, Kenny Pickett's the only real comparable, is Michael Penix was like tearing his ACL left and right like every other year. Kenny Pickett just sucked for 4 straight years before he was good in his 5th year. So at least Michael Penix has that asterisk where his supporters could, you know, say, well, he was injured for, you know, sure, basically every year at the beginning of his career. So he does have that outgoing for him.
That's fair. I'll just say, like, so Michael Penix in his best year still had a lower adjusted yards per attempt than the worst years of J.J. McCarthy or Caleb Williams, and it's marginally higher than the worst year of Drake May. If you're going to be living in the 5th year, 6th year range at quarterback, especially if you have the weapons that he had, like, I want otherworldly production, right? Like, give me Jaden Daniels 13.5 adjusted yards per attempt. Give me Bo Nix up over 11 adjusted yards per attempt. Like, if you're telling me you're a 5th, 6th year quarterback, like, you better be the best quarterback in college football. And you know, he was fine. He was a good college quarterback, but he wasn't tearing it up to the level that I would hope from a guy at that age with those weapons.
Yeah, and that's a valid stance to take. So let's transition a little bit away from the quarterbacks and wide receivers and a little bit away from the early round guys. And let's transition towards late round rookie running backs, which I know is probably one of your favorite positions to talk about, because I know you love doing the deep dives on the running backs. And I've talked a little bit about some of those guys. Like, I've only had 2 guests on the show so far. You're the 3rd of the 2024 season. At Kevin Coleman and Angelo from Angelo Analysis. So we talked about Kevin's top 5. Talked about a couple late guys, but really I want to hear about who are your guys, who are your flag plants, who are your late round running backs who you're super excited to draft right now.
Man, you know, it's not a great running back class, which I'm sure I'm not the first person telling you this. But I do think it's a deep running back class. So I'll give you like a couple of guys that I like in sort of the moderate deep range. You know, I still think they're probably gonna get drafted on day 3, but they're guys everyone's heard of. And then I'll give you a couple names that are, you know, further down the list. So, Will Shipley is a guy that I'm a lot higher on than consensus. one of the things I've really tried to focus on this year at the running back position is like trying to focus on guys who, you know, not only are leading with talent first, but have a trait that can get them on the field. I think Shipley is potentially the best route running back in this class. I know his receiving production is fine. It's not quite as exemplary. I think it's better on film than in the data, personally. I think Shipley can get on the field immediately as a third down back in the NFL. That would be my hope. And we've seen that type of profile where if you have receiving skills, and maybe you're not a great rusher, but you have you've shown the ability to sustain rushing volume, maybe you just sort of stay on the field by accident. You know, I think of a guy like a Rashad White who got on the field first as a pass catcher, really, and then wasn't a value-adding rusher necessarily, but was capable enough and had the college profile of a guy who can handle volume as a rusher, and they've just sort of made it work. You know, maybe it's not for super long term, but at least in the short to medium term, he's been able to be a workhorse. So that's the hope for Shipley is that he gets a role early on and develops. He's a guy I really think is smooth out of the backfield. The speed that he showed at the combine was really, or at his pro day, was really impressive running in the low 4.4s. It doesn't always show up for me on tape, but I do think that it can. And one note too, is he had an extremely high rate among backs in this class of rushes between the tackles, which just sucks. And so you look at some of his efficiency profile, some of his missed tackles forced, stuff like that. I think he's getting dragged down by just how often he was constantly force fed suboptimal carries instead of being given a chance to actually get out on the outside and show some of that athletic ability. The other guy that I really quite like is Audric Estime. I know his combine was a disaster. He runs the 4.71. You know, he follows it up at the pro day, runs over a tenth of a second faster there. Like, I don't know what his actual 40 time is. I know that his breakaway rates are among the highest in this class. I know that he's one of the most consistently efficient rushers relative to his teammates, relative to the situation in this class. And I really, really enjoy watching him run on film. You know, people forget that back before the Mike McDaniel era of the Shanahan zone scheme, they actually just used to have a bunch of really slow guys who like knew how to navigate their way across field. You know, look up Terrell Davis's 40 time. It's a 4.72. Like look up Ruben Drones's 40 time or Mike Anderson's 40 time or Alfred Morris, like any of these kind of archetype of guys. And that's where I see Estime. I think he is a really natural zone runner who just has an understanding of how to be able to pace his runs, how to maneuver through defenders, and how to consistently create value, even if he doesn't necessarily have that home run speed. So I think if he can get in a system, you know, where they run the zone scheme, he can be that rhythm back for them. Like I think of places like the Bengals or the Rams, kind of the Sean McVay branch of that tree, where they still do a little bit more of the inside zone. I think that would be really interesting for him. Way down the list, there's a guy, Kamani Vidal, who Noah Hills originally put me on, and I've become a fan of him now as well. Career high 315 touches, which is absolutely insane. Really like a violent runner, both in terms of he plays with a lot of force and physicality, and also has a really impressive ability to make cuts in very small areas. I think he's a really impressive back who just – frankly, is really one of the most fun backs to watch in this class and has one of the best volume maintenance profiles of anybody here where, you know, you look at these guys down the list, none of these guys are going to walk into starters. You're just sort of looking at what happens if they get benefited by situation, who has the ability to hold up to a workload and who potentially has some talent. I think Vidal is one of them. And the other guy in that same archetype for me is Isaiah Davis out of South Dakota State. Another guy, really high volume history, efficient, two seasons over 6 yards per carry, two seasons with over 20 yards per reception, you know, comes in the mid 4.5s. The combine is always a little bit hard to understand the athleticism when you're watching, you know, them play in the FCS against future mechanics and carpenters. You know, it's like, you're always wondering, are they fast or is everybody else slow? But with Isaiah Davis, I do think, you know, another guy I think has a pretty intuitive ability to be able to work at his own pace. Certainly a guy who's been able to lead efficient, high volume rushing offenses. So those are probably the four that I could see myself clicking a lot in rookie drafts in the third and then some of those later guys into the fourth rounds.
Yeah, I love the names you mentioned. A couple of them have come up earlier in the previous two podcasts as well. And Will Shipley was one of Kevin's favorites. And I mentioned this before, very early in the 2024 offseason, when I just started gathering notes on these players, like the most basic stuff in terms of declare status, in terms of recruiting grade, just the most basic information about them. I gathered a list of prospects who had a 95 plus recruiting grade and declared early after three seasons. We had Caleb Williams, Drake May, Brock Bowers, J.J. McCarthy, Xavier Worthy, Troy Franklin, Brian Thomas Jr., Detavion Sanders, and Will Shipley. And at the time, I was getting those, you know, memes with the Army guys with the one clown lumped in. And people were like, Will Shipley, what the hell is he doing in there?
Yeah.
And he's somebody who has started to get a little bit more steam as the process has picked up. And I would say the one concern I had in my note gathering process was what you mentioned would be his yards after contact numbers. So I thought it was interesting that you brought up his volume and how he was getting, you know, force fed these carries. And that could have been holding his numbers down. So maybe you're a little bit higher. Daniel Jeremiah just released his rankings and he has Shipley at 92 overall. One spot behind Trey Benson at 91 and two spots behind Blake Corum at 90, who's another guy who had really bad yards after contact, but had a very high volume as well. So do you kind of feel the same way where that volume is hindering Corum's yards after contact attempt? I know he's not a late round guy you mentioned, but what are your thoughts on him?
Yes and no. First off, I found the tweet that I was looking for with Shipley. So it's from Hayden Winks. Only 9% of Will Shipley's carries were outside carries. That partially explains his broken tackle rate because they're easy to produce out in space. For context, Braylon Allen was at 27%, Trey Benson 32%, Bucky Irving 25%. So, I mean, we're talking about a guy who's getting like three times as few outside carries. And the yards after contact is big because you break a tackle running straight up the middle and often 6 feet later is someone else to tackle you. You break a tackle, you know, on the sideline and all of a sudden you might get 20 yards out of it. You brought up Blake Corum. I think the big thing with him is just the injury. Blake Corum's missed tackles, force rates, yards after contact rate were not like exceptional in 2022, but they were certainly fine in 2022. Fell off a cliff in 2023 after he has this meniscus injury. I'm pretty confident just in terms of how, like, I've watched a lot of Corum and I really like how he plays the game. I think he's the most cerebrally sound running back in this class in terms of just making the right decisions and knowing where to go with the ball. I think he's the same guy, you know, at least between the years from 22 to 23. And I think he has the same capabilities in theory. I'm convinced the injury set him back. What I don't know is whether he can come back from it, right? It's kind of like the conversation that I've been having with Kyle Pitts this offseason, which is like, I'm pretty confident we can blame the injury for some part of it. I'm less confident that like that necessarily means that he just gets to come back to full health. Like, I'm not a doctor. I don't know. Sometimes you get injured and life's not fair, but sometimes you just never really recover exactly who you were before that injury. So I don't know what to make of Corum necessarily. You know, the medical people that I've looked at seem to be reasonably optimistic about him getting back to full strength, but you just never know. Everybody heals differently. I do think there is something to it though. Like, Corum is, you know, playing in an offense that's playing 1800s football, right? So, you know, you watch one game of Blake Corum tape, you watch one game of like Jalen Wright tape, it's like they're not playing the same position, right? One guy, we're running four wide receivers split about a foot from the out of bounds line, where if the defense wants to play two high safeties, I mean, they're getting split 15 yards each off the tackle box, and it's five linemen versus five defensive linemen and linebackers. Everybody block one, and if you win your blocks, no one's catching you for 30 yards. And if one of them blows a block, you're getting tackled for 2 yard loss. But like, it's Dixie Chicks, right? It's wide open spaces. You then look at Corum and it's like, we're bringing in the fullback, we're bringing in two tight ends, the defense has got nine in the box, we've got eight blocking them when we're running power out. Like, it's just a different scenario. Obviously, your yards after contact is not going to be as high when such a high volume of your carries are just being run into the wall like a battering ram versus when you know, some of these spread offenses these days are just coming up the line with two plays. And it's like, oh, is the defense going to leave five in the box? I'll hand it off. Is the defense not? Well, we'll pull it. You know, you also got to think too, like, how do these RPO offenses affect some of these stats? With the rise of the RPO, I mean, college coaches are literally designing an offense in which we only hand it to the running back if he has the numbers on his side. Otherwise, the quarterback keeps it, right? So so obviously, that's going to put guys like Marshawn Lloyd or guys like Jalen Wright in really advantageous situations, because that's quite literally the only time that they get the ball on a lot of these drives is when the quarterback's deciding, oh, the edge rusher is trying to tackle me, not them. So that's the kind of thing that the stats can't always take into account. Whereas Corum, on a ton of his carries, like, there's no one is as unclear as to what the play is going to be. You know, everybody's looking at the formation, the quarterback, the running back, the defensive lineman, and everybody watching in the stadium knows it's going to Blake Corum, and let's see what happens on the play. So that would be my defense of Corum. It's not, you know, as clean and as data precise as the Shipley one. But I guess I have a certain level of appreciation for how Corum plays the game. And I'm willing to cape up for him a little bit. I ultimately have him at RB3, but I do have concerns about his fantasy upside.
Yeah. And I love how you brought up another guy, and that would be Kimani Vidal. And he has become a little bit of a late round favorite amongst, I would say, everyone. It was no one to start with. And now it's becoming everyone. Me and Angelo agreed. We did true or false. I said true or false. Kimani Vidal is the late round running back to draft in round four of rookie drafts. And he agreed. He said true. You know, and when you look at the guy, he's a 4-year starter. Okay, number one, that's great. What do we ask players to do? We ask them to produce. We ask them to produce early. He did that. He was highly productive. Not just a starter. He was a highly productive starter. He was over 1,000 yards in each of his last two seasons, second in the NCAA in rushing yards last year. He had the second most broken tackles. He had 94 broken tackles on 297 attempts. So that's like one every three attempts this dude is breaking a tackle on average. Talk about athleticism. I was not expecting that, but he went to the combine. You look at this guy, weighs in at 5'8", 213. Like, he's just wrecking ball, like mini wrecking ball size. But he's yoked up. And then he puts a 4.46 40, a 37-inch vertical. I mean, he shows that he's a good athlete, too. Talk about how are you going to get on the field as like a late-round running back. He's got that pass-blocking ability. Best pass-blocking grade in the class in 2023 out of any running back. So there's just so much to like about Kimani Vidal. I know Jax Falcone loved him. I know Angelo loves him.
Oh, yeah.
I love him. You love him.
I'm a big fan of him.
I just saw Brett Coleman posted today. He's got Kimani Vidal as his RB5 in his rankings. So I just love that people are coming around on him. I hope that he can get like fourth round draft capital, semi-decent landing spot, so we can still draft him at a decent price. And, you know, it's not like the Damian Pierce extravaganza where, all right, he gets drafted to the Chargers in the fourth round and now he's the 110 or something. Like, you know, everybody in the world wants Kimani Vidal. We'll see. But I'm very interested in him as well. I think that was a great name to bring up. And I'll bring up one more name. I wasn't planning on bringing him up, but you brought up Vidal and Estime, and I have one guy literally sandwiched in between those two in my rankings right now. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on him. And that would be Tyrone Tracy Jr. And he's a guy I like a lot just based on traits. He played wide receiver four seasons at Iowa, even his first year at Purdue. They didn't switch him to running back or back. I think he was a high school running back. Back to running back until his sixth year. But he was great at the combine. He looks like a running back. He was, what, 5'11", over 210 pounds, sub 4.5 40, like 40-inch vertical. I mean, Tyrone Tracy's a guy I'm very interested in. What are your thoughts on him?
I can't believe he didn't play at Memphis. You know, we're bringing back the Tony Pollard, Antonio Gibson profile. If I have one wet blanket thought on Tyrone Tracy, it's that he's still a long ways away as a rusher, in my opinion. He's 24 years old. It's a little more fun to make the developmental switching positions bet if you're not already 24 years old. He'll turn 25 actually during his first NFL season, which is not really what you want, again, out of a developmental project, but still super fun, you know, like athleticism for days. You have theoretical receiving upside. Okay, I'll do one more wet blanket on Tyrone Tracy. We often think as a community when we get these like converted wide receiver types into running back, that everybody immediately starts thinking about their passing game upside. The biggest driver of who plays in third downs and 2 minute drills and comeback mode in the NFL is pass protection. And the players who have a lot more experience doing that are actual running backs, not receivers, right? Like you think about Antonio Gibson, took him a long time before he got trusted in that type of role. Tony Pollard took him a long time before he got trusted in that type of role. Cordarrelle Patterson, you know, he was subbing off when he had his big season. He was the one playing on early downs. Mike Davis was coming in to play in passing situations because, you know, they actually just because he had more experience being a running back as an outlet, as a pass protector. So anyway, all that stuff, those are the wet blanket aspects. But in terms of an explosive guy who has the hands, who can be an immediate weapon and a gadget player in the screen game, like absolutely. I'm in on Tyrone Tracy from a dart throw perspective, and he'll be cheap. So certainly a really fun player to bet on.
Yeah, and just to try and dry off your wet blankets, for the late age, I would just say that's a very valid point. But again, as dynasty managers, as soon as we get in season, the long term goes out the window. Like Dalton Kincaid, the same things were said about him last year. All right, he's an old prospect. Like, and now you look at, all right, just based on the offseason in a half, I wouldn't say half a season, he had a good rookie season, but he's a highly coveted asset, even though he's an older prospect, even though he didn't light the world on fire as a rookie. So if Tyrone Tracy is able to, you know, scratch his way into a role year one, totally. I don't think too many people are going to end up holding that against him. And I would also say the guys he comes to me, like you say, Antonio Gibson, I wouldn't say anybody's pounding the table that Antonio Gibson is the greatest pass blocker in the world. So if you can be dynamic enough and better than the options on your depth chart, so landing spots obviously going to be huge for Tracy, I think he could still get, you know, a role to an immediate role in year one as that receiving down running back. Because you talk about guys like, how do they have a certain skill like Will Shipley to get him on the field as a receiver? I think Tyrone Tracy does have skills as a receiver that maybe some other teams just don't have on their depth chart right now. So that could be totally one guy who I would keep my eye on as well. And that's pretty much it for the player discussions. I know we're running a little long, which we expected, but I'm going to try and finish this up shortly. The last thing I want to talk about, though, before we put you on the hot seat and do the rapid fire, is one more grand philosophical question. And this might not be one that people actually face too often in reality, but they might face something similar to it, where, all right, maybe they went into a rebuild and they only have one or two assets on their roster, but they have a boatload of picks. So this hypothetical situation I want to propose to you, and what I'm curious as to how you would approach it, would be if you had zero assets, literally zero assets, you don't have any players on your team, but you have every single rookie pick in the 2024 draft in a super flex league. You got the 101, 102, you got every pick, 101 through 412, every pick is yours. How are we building a team, a dynasty roster out of these picks? What is the game plan here?
Yeah, I took this question very literally. And what I saw on the show sheet, I first went and I figured, okay, what kind of value team do I have here in this situation? So I also went and made the assumption that I have all my own picks in 2025 and 2026, but none of anybody else's. So that was for the purpose of this exercise. So the average team per my value charting in a 12-team league has about 15 base firsts. And this team in this hypothetical exercise actually works out to where they'd have about 21 or 22. So quite a high value team. So again, obviously this exercise is hyperbolic, but this concept is not going to be foreign to a lot of people. This is basically what most teams are in after a year one intentional tank, which is that they have a surplus of value because they didn't spend any of their assets on guys who were declining in value. They bought the whole tax on a bunch of future picks, but they probably don't have a team that's very capable of scoring points, and they got to figure out what to do. do you wait another year and build up value gradually? Do you make all the picks? You know, do you make some trades? My rule of thumb is that if you can be a top three or top four value team in your league, a market value team in your league, and compete, then you should always do that. And that doesn't necessarily mean, am I top three or four now? Compete. You know, if you have to lose so much value in the course of converting your team to competing that you're no longer a high value team, probably don't do that. But if at the end of whatever trades you have to make, you can come out of it and be, you know, a top three, four production team and a top three, four value team, I think that you should always make that move because, you know, that's going to be better overall for your expected value. You want to be trying to lengthen your contention window as much as possible rather than just stocking up to have the best possible team in one given year, because every playoff matchup is basically a 55-45. So you can't ever depend on just because you have a juggernaut, that's going to be the year you win it all. You want to be constantly trying to extend your contention window when you're old, adding some picks. If you're young, trying to add some veterans to win a little bit earlier. So what would I do? You know, I think to me, four absolute blue chip players in this class where I would need like considerably above market value to not pick them. So I would want to pick Caleb Williams, Marvin Harrison, Malik Nabers, Brock Bowers. You know, you probably don't have to pick Bowers at four in most leagues. You know, you can probably suss out your managers and figure out where you need to pick them and maneuver the draft board accordingly. Everybody else, you know, let's see what happens. Let's get on the phone lines, right? I wouldn't be moving the future picks. I'd want to keep those. And I would probably be trying to look at what are some of the ways I can get a lot of bang for my buck, right? Who are the players that project for the most production for their market value? I'm talking about guys like a Derrick Henry, you know, guys like a James Conner, where if you can just fill a spot in your lineup that's currently unfilled with a guy who could score 14 to 16 points per game and cost very little, you know, that's ideal. And no better time to do that at the draft when everybody wants to get those rookie picks. Who do you target precisely? You don't target the players. You target the managers. Who are the managers that have an excess of whatever you need? Who are the managers that might be looking to rebuild? Whatever reason, who are the managers that are incentivized to sell you the stuff that you want? And then you just take whoever's on their roster. And so I'd be looking to consolidate picks into a few veterans, add those four blue chip guys, and then just kind of figure out the roster from there. But I would definitely compete. That would be kind of the way that I would do it. How did you take this question? I thought this was a really, really fun thought exercise.
Yeah, I would say I'm on the same page with you because there's so many ways to just turn that value into a competing team right away. And you look about, all right, even if you're going to just draft Caleb Williams, Marv, Nabers, and Bowers, you still have high-value assets like Jane Daniels. You could sell him for a wide receiver. Yeah. Even if you lost value on that, you could bring back like a Jalen Waddle, a Brandon Ayuk, probably get a plus on top of that. All of a sudden, now you have Marv, Nabers, Ayuk. All right, you have Bowers, who should be productive. To me, I think number one priority is getting two elite quarterbacks. When you have that kind of value, if you're coming out with a team on the other side that doesn't have two elite quarterbacks, I think you messed up. I think when you have, especially guys like Justin Herbert, it's like, how much do we have to add to Jaden Daniels? A couple late twos, like to go get a proven guy in a Justin Herbert, you know, Kyler Murray. How much do I got to add to Jaden Daniels to go get Kyler Murray? A late two, you know, in a three? Like, what exactly do I have to add there? So I think going and getting at least one proven guy, so you're not just coming out with Caleb and Daniels or May. I think that's a huge point for me. But other than that, yeah, like, you can get some of these guys for a second or pair of seconds for these veteran running backs, and Alvin Kamara would be the number one for me. You mentioned Henry and Connor. I love those guys as well. But Alvin Kamara, RB3 last year behind only CMC and Kyron Williams. And it's like, what do I have to pay for him? A semi-mid two, like a high two? So I think you can get away with adding two RB1s just with a couple second-round picks. Then you still have half your second-round picks. You can fill out your roster. So I think when you're looking at teams that have all these picks, for me, I like to just go towards the veteran options. Like, I wouldn't say I have to draft Malik Nabers or even Brock Bowers or even Marvin Harrison Jr. If I can get A.J. Brown in a two for Marv, you know, I'm open to that. If I can get Brandon Ayuk plus for Malik Nabers, what kind of plus are we talking? Then I can maybe even use another leverage point. For me, it would be, you said your assumption is you don't have any other teams future first. I would assume that as well. Let's go get some more, right? People want the late twos. Let's trade Malik Nabers and the 212 for Brandon Ayuk in a 2025 first or 2026 first. And then it's like, all right, now I have a similar wide receiver. And I just turned a late two into another future first, where now I'm stacking more value in the future, you know, to go collect more high value assets. So I think you brought up a lot of great points. We want to go compete right away when you have value, and it's very important. I think that's a good point. You talk about, you used a number. Where were you coming up with that number for value?
Yeah, so I just went through and I added up the value that I have on each of the first eight guys individually. And then I looked up, okay, how many guys do I have ranked as an early second, which is in my chart equivalent to 0.5 base ones. And I just times that by 0.5. And then everybody I have base. Anyway, I just went down the list and just literally added up all of the players and then added on the futures. And I think I got to like 22. And so what I've done before, and I forget the exact number, but I as just like a way of sort of measuring the value of my team versus average. And obviously I want to be, if I'm measuring my own team, I certainly want to be ahead of average because I'm measuring the value of my team with literally my own scale. So I should I'm probably going to like my players more than average. So I should, if I'm truly average, I should be like a full first or two above average for that to make any sense. But I'll go through and I basically took the entirety of the base first of my rankings, right? So I just added up literally every player from front to back. What does that equal to? Divide by 12 teams. And that's, you know, what I would consider to be my average value team. And then if I add up the value of my own players on that chart versus that, I kind of get at least a vague idea of where I stand in the league economy. In terms of if I think I'm in a decent position to continue or if it's time to, you know, panic and think about trying to rebuild this thing.
Yeah. And there are all sorts of other like free available tools too. Like Dynasty Daddy's one, like, and they'll literally give you
easily
values of each team in your Dynasty League. And I think that's a very important point that you bring up is knowing where you sit in terms of the value hierarchy, because there might be teams who maybe they don't have 101 through 112, but maybe they have 101 through 107 and they're the second most valuable team in their league. But they think, oh, I'm drafting all these young players and 101 through 107. And then their second round picks, they're just thinking, oh, I'm still young. I'm rebuilding. Like I'm going to keep drafting these young players when they could be turning those second round picks into, you know, Alvin Kamara and Derrick Henry. And all of a sudden,
I mean,
that team's smashing in year one.
You'll see teams get stuck in this infinite loop where you build up the value. They don't do anything with it. They just make their picks. Some of the picks hit, but, you know, maybe a little bit more than they hoped miss. And then they don't really have enough juice on their team to contend. So then they have to then sell off at the deadline again. And then you end up in this, like, this is how you end up in the infinite rebuild, right? You know, and I have a lot of content on rebuilding on the site. It's like one of my favorite topics. And in my view, like, I think, you know, if you don't have the juice, you don't have the juice. I think selling off is the sharp play. Teams should sell off and they should sell off aggressively and not hold that value atrophy on their team. But teams should be buying back just as aggressively once they get to the value stage. I'm not saying that means you don't make any picks, you know, but I don't think that, you know, I like making rookie picks. I want to be overweight on rookies pretty much across the board. But it all just comes back to that rule of thumb, which is like, if you have the value to compete, you should compete. Otherwise, you end up in a spot where you're wasting years. And, you know, sometimes these teams will actually hit on the rookie picks and they'll build the juggernaut, but it takes them 3 years or whatever. And so then you're still have sacrificed a lot of expected value to actually get to that juggernaut team. Or, you know,
and what once looked like this elite up and coming team, not so much, right? I mean, this is the thing with rookies. You hold a future pick, very safe store of value. Like that just gets more valuable every year until a rookie catches it. Rookies, pretty good store of value. You know, for every Quentin Johnston, there's more not Quentin Johnstons, right? Some rookies will fall off a cliff, but on net, you draft this entire rookie class, you'll have a more valuable roster next year than you have right now on aggregate. That's almost certain. But second-year players, third-year players, like, you know, look at this. It's one thing to look at the truly elite guys. You know, you look at like a Bijan Robinson, you look at a CJ Stroud, right? Like, I'm not worried about their value this year, but, you know, especially think down the list, like look at, you know, look at a group of guys like a Zay Flowers to a JSN to a Jaden Reed to a Jack Smith and Jigba. Like, I bet one of those guys or even two of those guys takes a leap forward this year. I'll tell you right now, a couple of those guys are going to be worth dust next year. Right? It doesn't sound nice right now, but like, look at where Traylon Burks was valued this time last year. Look at where Jahan Dotson's valued this time last year. Right? Like, you get some guys like a Pickens that it's like, okay, they stabilize and maybe even move up a little bit. I'm trying to think if there was anyone from last year's class that like massively improved their value at the wide receiver position, maybe more at the running back position with White and Cook a little bit. But like, most players, like if they're going to become that first, second round startup pick, it usually kind of happens right away. And otherwise, you're hoping that they just kind of stay where they are, right? Or sometimes they fall completely off a cliff. Because when we're valuing these guys, like we're baking in progression, right? If a Jordan Addison just has the same season he had last year, his value's going to fall by four rounds. We're expecting him to be better. So it's hard when you're – if you're just hoping that your team just gradually progresses, you know, this isn't 2K. You don't get 5 points on the overall every year. You know, it's just not how it works.
Yeah, that's a great analogy to make, and I love how you said that it's not 2K because it's totally true. And sometimes we just expect every second-year player to get better, but then there's plenty of times we get those Jahan Dotsons, those Traylon Burks, the Elijah Moores, and it goes the opposite, or Jerry Jeudy, and it's just all of a sudden 2-3 years later, these guys are the third wide receiver on their depth chart. Nobody gives a shit about them anymore. So the dynasty tides turn quick. That's it for the show sheet. We got one thing left. It's going to be the 90-second rapid-fire hot sheet. I'm going to let you reset your mic. It looks like it came or sounds like it came unplugged one more time. I'll let you reset that once, and then we'll finish up with the rapid-fire.
My goodness. I don't know what the heck today, but not loving it. I think we are good now.
Okay, yes, let's do the rapid-fire. You are. You sound very clear. All right, so this is your third time doing the 90-second rapid fire on the hot seat. You know the deal. Listeners are starting to know the deal. This is their third time listening to it. So we're going to assume 12-team super flex 1.5 dynasty, 1.5 tight end premium for dynasty format. Do you have any other questions before we start?
No, let's do it.
All right, so I'm going to give you about half and half. About half of these are going to be first round picks and about half of these are going to be second round picks. So we'll start the timer after the first question. In a 12-team super flex 1.5 tight end premium league, are you taking 101 or Justin Herbert?
Justin Herbert.
102 or Kyler Murray?
Ooh, I think I have Kyler Murray ranked higher. I'll take Kyler Murray.
107 or Devon Achane?
I'll take the 107.
108 or Jackson Smith and Jigba?
108.
108 or Bryce? Ooh, 108 or Bryce Young?
108.
110 or T. Higgins?
Oh, I'll take T. Higgins.
112 or David Njoku?
It would be team dependent and league dependent, but in a vacuum, David Njoku.
201 or Marquise Brown?
I'll take the 201.
201 or Ramondre Stevenson?
201.
205 or Tony Pollard?
I'll take the 205, I think.
205 or Christian Watson? I'll
say that one. Definitely the 205.
208 or Daniel Jones?
Ooh, fun one. 208 on 90% of teams.
208 or Jerry Jeudy?
208.
212 or Nick Chubb?
Give me Nick Chubb. Give me
212 Nick Chubb. Give me or Green. Kendre Miller?
212.
Ooh, all right. So you finished with 12 seconds to spare. There's a couple ones you said by a lot. Talk about 108 versus JSN.
I mean, look what we just talked about 5 minutes ago. Like, if you want to look at the profile of who falls off a cliff after their year one, the guy with the 1.32 yards per route run, it's not great. I mean, high pedigree player. It wouldn't surprise me if he bounced back. But this goes back to what I was saying about Adonai Mitchell, which is like, I feel like everyone now admits that the floor is lower on JSN, but I don't think that the market has really changed their ceiling priors. The idea is like, look, okay, yeah, maybe it's not going great right now, but like the ceiling is so great. Like, I've seen people say on Twitter, like, yeah, it's just the situation, but we know he has the talent. It's like, we know he has the talent. I get if you think that he has the talent. You know what? The situation hasn't changed since he was drafted. Right. So if we felt actually the same about the talent, his ADP would be the same as it was, you know, his value would be the same as it was last year. He would still be the second coming if this situation was so predictable. But it's BS. People didn't think that the situation would hold him back like it did last year. They wouldn't have drafted him highly. And when I say people, I'm including myself with that. I drafted him last year. I thought he was a great prospect. I'm not absenting myself from this. But be honest with yourselves, right? It's one thing if he had come off a year where he had a 2.1 yards per route run and 24% targets per route run, and Pete Carroll was a boomer and he kept running two tight end sets, so he only ran 70% of the routes. All right, I'm in on JSN at that point. His value would also be three rounds higher, right? But he when he ran routes, he ran a lot of them, and he wasn't as good as DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett last year. That's just the facts of the matter. Maybe he's better than them this year. I don't know. But I tend to think that if he was truly elite, that he probably would have showed more upside than he did in year one. And I think that he's at high risk if he doesn't take that big leap forward, and it needs to be a big leap forward, of vanishing off the face of the earth. So once it gets into guys like him versus, you know, your Worthies and your Mitchells and your Thomases, I think it's a conversation, because I think those guys obviously have a very low floor, and whether you'd rather re-roll it or stick with the pedigree, I think that if you, and I have all those guys ahead of JSN, but if you made the argument for JSN there, I think that's reasonable, and I'm not going to fight you on it. Tell me I can just re-roll him into the fifth overall pick quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings? Like, no brainer. Yes. Same with Bryce Young, right? Like, you know, that's like, I just hit my ball out of bounds and you're the guy in the golf cart saying, do you want a mulligan? Like, yes, I want a mulligan. I'd love to tee it up. Like, hand me a Titleist. Like, I mean, I like Bryce Young as a prospect more than McCarthy, but you know what I liked? I liked Bryce Young as a prospect more than I liked Bryce Young as a prospect, plus a year of sucking ass on the Carolina Panthers. So I would prefer to re-roll that into another quarterback instead of him. I just think so many times when people blame, people should pick a lane. If you're blaming, if you're saying that year one, you know, Bryce Young couldn't have done anything, the situation was so bad. JSN couldn't have done anything, the situation was so bad. One of two things. Either point me to the data which suggests that they were a victim of situation and that they weren't just not good enough. Or show me the tweet from August of last year when you said, I'll buy these guys when they're three rounds cheaper because the situation is so bad, no one can withstand it. But one of the two, don't you know, believe in the players. Oh, they're going to overcome this. Oh, they couldn't overcome it, but they're still just as good. You know, pick a lane. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and I'll give you the J.J. McCarthy over JSN take. I won't even argue that point. But I'm going to play hardcore devil's advocate with you here, because I'm on the other side of the fence with JSN. And I love how, again, you brought up that ceiling versus floor debate and how we were talking about it earlier in the show and about how nobody's really adjusting their ceiling expectations for JSN based off of his rookie season. And I don't know that they should. And another guy who comes to mind for me for this philosophical debate would be Trey McBride. And obviously, we're talking about different positions here, but we're talking about a college prospect who is regarded in high regard, who is extremely productive in college, who is a high-level athlete for their position. JSN is one as well. He ran 3.93 shuttle, which is the fastest shuttle time of any wide receiver since, I think, 2014. So we have that high-end athleticism. And then we talk about year one, all of the bad stuff, the yards per route run. Trey McBride, same thing. Yards per route run was shit. PFF grading year one, it was shit. But the situation was also shit. He was trapped behind Zach Ertz. He was playing with David Blau, Trace McSorley, and I can't even forget the third quarterback when Kyler Murray was injured, when he actually got on the field and Zach Ertz was hurt. And then we saw Trey McBride. That ceiling was intact in his second season, and that college prospect was the same guy who struggled in year one. And anybody who said, oh, now he can't hit that elite ceiling, was proven wrong. So we have seen guys who come into the NFL as excellent prospects, as excellent athletes, who are in bad situations, struggle year one, and we still do see them hit elite ceilings. Trey McBride was like number one target earner for the tight as a tight end in his time as a starter. I don't think anybody's arguing him as a lean option anymore. JSN, I do think you can point to the situation and you just look at the way he was utilized. Basically, strictly slot, strictly in a low A dot role. And everybody saw the interview, JSN being asked about his old coordinator, and he basically bit his tongue for about 30 seconds. And I was like, yeah, guy's great. Next question. That's paraphrasing, but and you watch the film. This guy was not even being allowed to run real routes down the field. So I do feel like that change in coordinator, he dealt with some injuries in his rookie season, which kind of delayed the timeline a little bit. Tyler Lockett's only another year older. I mean, I can see JSN still breaking out. I'll give you the JJ.
I can too. I'm not writing him off.
In a good spot, Xavier Worthy, maybe. I'm not taking Ryan Thomas Jr. I'm not taking Adonai Mitchell over Jaxon Smith-Njigba, who to me was a far superior college prospect and who I can find valid reasons for. And I don't think his production was that astonishingly horrendous. He still had 64 receptions as a rookie in a crowded run-first offense.
They weren't really that run-first. We talk about expected year two progression.
What's he at? 80 receptions? 85 plus? Like, maybe not the most efficient receptions, but I still see a high-volume workload, high-volume ceiling. I could still see this guy putting up an 110-plus reception season in his career. I don't think that ceiling is all of a sudden gone just because he had a bad year one.
I don't think that it's off the table. My question is the ceiling on him, like, because the issue with him is like he has no value leash. If we start in the first month of the season, it's back to three catches for 35 yards and four catches for 42 yards every week. Like, people will be like, oh yeah, right. This is what he's been his whole NFL career. Like, and the value is going to go down the tubes. So all these rookies have a longer value leash than him. And then it's okay. Do we think that this guy has a higher ceiling based off the pedigree, after we've already seen him be mediocre in the NFL, than the mystery box? And, you know, he definitely has a higher ceiling, I think, than like some of the mystery boxes, right? Like, if we extend out this theory, whenever we're doing this with a heuristic, it's like, does JSN have a higher ceiling than Roma Dunes? Or, I mean, when we say higher ceiling, what we really mean, of course, is like likelihood of hitting a ceiling. Every player has functionally the same 100th percentile outcome. Does he have a higher ceiling than Roma Dunze? I think we would all agree, no. Does he have a higher ceiling than Javon Baker? Obviously, yes. So it's like, where do we draw the line? And I don't know. I think it's in somewhere in that tier, from the Worthy to Thomas to Mitchell group, of where the pedigree versus the unknown kind of equalizes for me. I don't want to write him off. I mean, I take your Trey McBride point, and that's a good one. I mean, the counterexample would be like Rashad Bateman, who had a pretty similar year one to Jaxon Smith-Njigba and was also a really strong high pedigree prospect and just never fired. You know, and I think there's examples from both ends, which I really think it can go either way for him. It just comes down to the cost. Like, everywhere I have JSN, I'm putting him on the block. And if someone is giving me a bet like a JJ McCarthy, where I think I'm getting enough of a floor and enough upside where I don't feel like I'm sweating the whole JSN deal, it's just set and forget for me. the Xavier Worthy one, like that makes me queasy in either direction. It's like I could see a world where JSN hits and I feel sick to my stomach about the decision that I made. I also could see him dropping like a stone. So for me, it's a matter of like, I'm not out in all circumstances, but I want to see if I can get a bet instead of him that has this, that has the same type of stealing that he does, where I'm not as, I just don't have to worry about the FOMO of him. Right. I mean, I would argue it's kind of the same scenario. There's differences, of course, but like it'd be kind of the same thing I would say about like a Kyle Pitts, where like I still feel really good about the ceiling of him based on the pedigree and on the early year production. If someone's telling me, okay, you can have Kyle Pitts or Dalton Kincaid, I'm like, I don't know. You know, Kincaid's probably safer value wise, but I still feel better about the Pitts ceiling. If you're telling me, oh, you can have Pitts or Brock Bowers, it's like, great. I get the same ceiling. I don't have to worry about all the baggage. Like, oh, awesome. Like, I'll just take Brock Bowers. That sounds terrific to me. You know, that's how I kind of see it. So it's like to McCarthy and Adunze, slam dunk. No worries. I don't know. I'm torn with those other guys. I have them all in the same tier, I think.
I think Odunze is a clear reflip. I'd definitely take him Brock Bowers over Kyle Pitts as well. I will push back on the value leash argument of it, though, because you say these rookie wide receivers have a longer value leash than JSN. You know, if he starts bad, do they really? We look at Quentin Johnston. All right, as a rookie, he had a shit year. By week four, the red flags were going up in the dynasty community. By week six, the dynasty community was in agreement that this guy was shit and his value was in the tank before we were at the halfway point in the season. So I'm not sure that these rookies are just insulated very far, to be honest, because we want production early, especially when we're investing a late first round pick into these rookies. So I think the onus is going to be on them to produce. And we talk about what happens if JSN does produce at the same level as them or higher. He just has a much higher brand recognition than an Xavier Worthy or a Brian Thomas or an Adonai Mitchell.
Whoa, what the hell? Oh, my lamp just my lamp just went out. That's what happened. One second. We got a backup lamp in here somewhere. There we go. Crazy. All right, I'll have to change a light bulb shortly after this. Anyway, with JSN, I mean, look, that's how fast it can go for any of these guys. You know, for JSN, for one of the rookies, someone turns off the light when you least expect it. That's the metaphor. We were talking about the rookies. I think Quentin Johnston is like a particularly unique circumstance in that for most rookies that fail, there's like some sort of line of excuses we can point to for a while that makes the decline a little more gradual, right? Like Sky Moore wasn't playing. Traylon Burks was dealing with injuries. And then a lot of guys who like just aren't as bad as Quentin Johnston was. Like you look at like a Jahan Dotson or a Burks, whatever. It's like there's still some actual hope along the way. Bateman, Elijah Moore, all these examples. Chenault, whatever. Where like it actually takes a while until it becomes clearly apparent that they don't have it. With Johnston, it was a mix of A, everyone already kind of had the perception that he was a boom bust profile going in. And then B, all of his environmental factors, he hit the nuts immediately, right? Like he lands with Herbert and Mike Williams goes down for the season in like week two. And so it's like, oh, like, all right, buddy, like here's your time. And then he was like, I'm not it, guys. and not only like not it, but like abjectly putrid. And so it was like there was nowhere to hide, right? Like it was just like if Mike Williams doesn't get hurt and Quentin Johnson's just not playing, it would have been like I think a more slow, gradual of like, oh, like does this guy just suck or are they just easing him in? Like we don't know for sure. But when it was like, oh, he's running all the routes. And it's not because he earned it. Like he ran all the routes because everyone else got hurt. And then he did nothing on all those routes. And his quarterback is Justin Herbert. It's like, I think the problem's you, buddy. Like I think the problem is you.
Yeah, that's a very
all that
good
being
point
said, he was, I mean, this year, he's like somewhat movable for a second, like now. I don't really know how, but I have seen it in leagues that people are able to still move him for like 26 twos for some reason.
Not my second.
No, not my second. Yeah. I just want to be clear. Like you know, the original question is 108. I looked at my ranks. I have all in the same tier, by the way. I have Worthy, McConkey, and Thomas currently ahead of JSN. I have JSN ahead of Mitchell. All of those guys being in the same tier. So, I mean, I have no major issue on someone preferring JSN over any of those guys. You know, everyone I look at in my tier that's ranked a full tier above them, like, yeah, I feel pretty good about that. You know, like in terms of the veterans that I have above them that are comparably young, it's like, you know, it's George Pickens, it's Ken Walker, it's James Cook, it's you know, guys like Higgins into the Aiyuks and Smiths and up into the rest. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't be super shocked if he hit. I don't think it's like the most. I just don't think it's the most likely scenario that he hits at like a top 12 level. I think that probably the most likely scenario is that he's like a top 24 to 36 wide receiver. And then from there, I think like the big hit or the big bust are relatively equal outcomes to me beyond that.
Fair enough, man. I appreciate it. We went probably twice as long as I usually do, which honestly not to be expected when we put you and me together. I know both of us love to just go on and on. And sure. Again, thank you. You gave us a ton of time, and we got an hour and a half here, basically, more than that. So thank you again for spending all the time you did with us tonight, man. I really appreciate it. Got to a lot of great topics. Can you just tell everyone where they can subscribe to your newsletter before we go?
Oh, absolutely. You can subscribe to me on Thinking About Thinking, which is just my name, jacobsanderson.substack.com. You can also just scroll to my Twitter. I tweet out almost all my articles and the links to those. You can see my most recent two articles on the draft, pre-draft, and I'll have more of everything post-draft. You can also find me doing plenty of draft content over the 3 days. I'll be live for at least a portion of the Ship Chasing cast on Thursday. I'll be on with Mike Zoltan right after the draft, breaking it down. I'll be on post-draft with the Dynasty Point guys on day two. We'll be streaming all day, day three. If you want my thoughts on rookie stuff during and directly after the draft, I'll just say they won't be hard to find. They'll be around.
Awesome, man. Thank you again. I'll let you go. I know you got a lamp light bulb you got to replace there. Have a good one, guys. Thanks for listening to the show. Obviously, you can check out my website as well, gurufantasyworld.com. You can find all sorts of links there to anything you want, rankings, Patreon, Discord, all that fun stuff. Have a good one, guys. Take it easy.